Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. In just 8 days, over 4,000 athletes from dozens of countries will file into Rio's Maracanã Stadium for the opening ceremonies of the 2016 Paralympic Summer Games. The games will feature, for the first time, a refugee team competing under the Paralympic flag. And as TV and online coverage expands, organizers are hoping to break the London Games record of nearly 3.5 billion viewers worldwide. There are also some controversies. The entire Russian team will not compete because of the doping scandal, which has engulfed Paralympics and Olympics alike. And last-minute funding issues put the travel plans of a number of countries to the Paralympics in jeopardy. We're going to talk about all of this as we take a close look at the Rio Paralympic Games today. Our guests include James Simbeta, on his way to Rio tomorrow. James is a wheelchair athlete who will compete for the first time in the Paralympics in the 800-meter, 5,000-meter, and marathon races. Welcome to Radio Times, James.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Eli Wolf was a member of the U.S. Paralympic soccer team for the 1996 and 2004 games and now advocates for athletes with disabilities. Hello, Eli.
Yes, hello.
And Scott Brown is one of the more decorated athletes in Paralympic rowing's brief international history. He currently works as an adaptive sports specialist in Jacksonville, Florida. Welcome, Scott.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure. So, James Simbeta, to you first. You're getting on that plane tomorrow. What are your thoughts?
I am totally excited for this experience. It's my first time going, and just to see the camaraderie, just to see the unity of all the nations in the world coming together just for this athletic event, and considering that this is the Paralympics, which is, you know, athletes with disabilities. It's more of a stage to show that, you know, individuals with disabilities aren't something to be pitied upon. We, too, can also be athletic and basically just appear as normal as anybody else.
How did you become interested in racing, James?
Initially, I went to the University of Illinois for engineering and was considering playing wheelchair basketball. But when I found out that my academic schedule and the practice schedule wasn't going to work out, I decided to just focus on my academics. And then one day I walked in and talked to the track coach, Adam Wheatley, and he just threw me in a track chair. And 4 years later, I'm now going to the Paralympics. So,
Eli Wolf, you had a stroke when you were a toddler, according to your bio, and you seem to have loved sports as a youth. How did you eventually connect with the Paralympics?
My trajectory really came just from being involved with mainstream sports, you know, competing in high school and then college. And I was actually just sort of spotted on the soccer field and got called in to a national training camp. And really my eyes then sort of opened up to kind of this whole world of adaptive and Paralympic sport. And for me, just realizing kind of how much there was an opportunity for the world to get to know and be more mainstream, and for athletes with disabilities to really be seen more as athletes first. And so that's really why I became an advocate and really became passionate about trying to raise the profile of opportunities for athletes with disabilities at all levels, not only at the Paralympic and Olympic level, but also at grassroots and high school, college, you know, at every level to create more visibility and opportunity.
Well, let's talk about the pipeline for a moment. You said you were spotted on a field. Is that common? You know, that sort of thing happens to an athlete who might be working with a disability and then on to training as a possible Paralympic athlete?
I think that the opportunities have really come a long way, you know, since when I was competing in the early 90s or whatnot. I think there has been more infrastructure that's being, you know, put in place, more opportunities for that infrastructure. So it's not just a random identification, but there really is more structure so that young people can be put into the right program, into whether it's through the school systems or through the community. So that a young person with a disability can be spotted from a development standpoint. So I think there is more and more in place. There's still a long way to go, I would say, in terms of, you know, there still are these kind of stories of just you know, people randomly still finding out about the Paralympics. But I think because the profile has been raised so much since, especially since 2012 from London, and then now going into Rio, but I still think there's still a long way to go, but we've come a long way for sure.
And Scott Brown, to you, tell us a bit about yourself and how you came to para rowing.
Well, oddly enough, I was not athletic before my accident. I had an accident back in 87 and was recruited for adaptive rowing by my occupational therapist. And I didn't participate in any sports whatsoever. And so this was my first introduction into sports at all. And it was, you know, as a disabled rower. And I just kind of naturally took to it. But I think for me, it was a big gateway into this new world. But I think it provided a pivotal part of my rehabilitation. I've always, you know, called it the rehab after rehab. For me and for many others, after an accident, you know, it's a traumatic event, obviously, and, sure. and it's difficult making that adaptation. And programs such as this really help to facilitate that. And it's really helped change my life and many others. So, I moved from Philadelphia to take a job in Jacksonville at Brooks Rehabilitation, where I work in adaptive sports, where I get to help. It's kind of like my payback. Now I'm giving back to folks that are newly injured, and I can help show them what they can aspire to.
And for clarity, Scott, how are the words para and adaptive used? Not quite interchangeably?
Well, no, they're not interchangeable. Adaptive is recreational rowing and higher levels. Para is elite. That's world championships and Paralympics.
So let's talk a little bit about the technology that is available to Paralympic athletes used to compete at the highest level. For instance, Scott, what changes are made to a boat to accommodate the athlete who has a disability?
Well, there's three different classifications in adaptive rowing or para rowing. And the leg, trunk, and arm division is the most stable. So they're single leg amputees, blind rowers. They're using very few adaptations, if any at all. A blind rower would need to use light occluding goggles. So, I mean, you can use swimming goggles, ski goggles, but you just have to black them out. And that would really be the only adaptation there. But I've seen arm amputees rowing with special modifications on their prosthetics. In my division, the trunk and arms use a fixed seat, straps. There's you start using a few more adaptations. You'll use different spreads and oar lengths and oar sizes when you start moving down the classification chain. Mm-hmm. And the arms and shoulders division, the most disabled, that's higher level spinal cords. Mm-hmm. They're using a chest strap, and they're going to be using the most modifications, maybe some hand grips and, mm-hmm. and things of that nature. But the arms and shoulders and trunk and arms divisions are both fixed seats, so you're actually mm-hmm. using a seat in the boat, so you're not using your legs to propel you any longer.
James Simbetta, let's go to you for a moment. Producer Liz Fiedler has posted a picture of one of your race gloves on the Radio Times Facebook page. Describe the glove, what happened to it. Tell us about, I guess, the intensity of the training, which I'm guessing led to its demise?
Not just the intensity of the training, but literally the duration and how long I've had the glove. When it comes to gloves, recently we build them out of Aquaplast, and some have even switched to 3D printing. And the drawback with Aquaplast is that after time, the material degrades because it's usually used as like a temporary cast. But most of us, we make the gloves and usually try to hold on for them for years, and eventually it breaks. Mm-hmm. Probably it's one of the things that's just as critical to a wheelchair racer as the racing chair itself. which is a
whole other... Why is
that? Basically, with the gloves, it's how you propel the chair. And depending on the type of gloves, there are different techniques. There's a finger foam trigger type of glove. There's flat. There's a hybrid. And usually you get used to one type of style, and when you change it, you change your stroke completely. Sometimes you have to move your arm out farther than you would normally want to, and you have to rebuild muscle memory from that.
Sure.
It's a little more complex than just pushing a regular everyday chair down the street. It's a little more involved.
So the technology is amazing and varied. And I just want to get back to Eli for a moment because we're up against a break, and I know Eli has to leave us after the first segment of Radio Times this hour. Eli, changing track here a bit, you are heading to Rio, but this time not as an athlete.
Yes. No, I'll be going down in a media role. I've been a part of a media company called Empower Sports. And we've been involved over the last couple of years with a lot of social media and online coverage to both aggregate but also create new content around adaptive sports and really actually pushing stories to the mainstream and working closely with different mainstream media outlets as well. And our big focus for our efforts in Rio is actually going to be not only the athletes but also the sports fans, because we feel like there's a lot to be told about sports fans and how – more and more people are now becoming fans of the Paralympics and fans of adaptive sport. And so we really want to be able to tell those stories. And really, that's been a passion of mine is the media and getting more and more of these stories out there. And so really excited to see those stories unfold in Rio.
And what are you hoping to accomplish by telling these stories?
I think part of it is to be able to continue to make the case and continue to be able to show the numbers of people that are engaging with and following the content and retweeting and liking and just really passionate about adaptive sports and the Paralympics. I think the numbers are continuing to grow and grow of people that are following adaptive sports, not only at the Paralympic Games, but in an ongoing way. So really you could say 365 coverage. And just in the way that we've seen kind of a growth of women's sports and women's coverage in the media, I think we're on to that kind of similar trajectory for the Paralympics and adaptive sports, that we're seeing that kind of growth in the media and the media coverage.
Yeah.
And I think especially social media has really helped that grow.
In about 10 seconds, Eli, sorry to jump in. I just wanted to know what you're feeling now that you're on the other side as an observer as opposed to an athlete.
I mean, for me, that's always been a passion of mine. You know, I've always had that athlete focus, but then for me, I was always just really passionate in terms of the media, in terms of being an advocate, in terms of policy. So, you know, my career over the last 15 years has really been focusing on that side of it.
We'll have to let you go. Unfortunately, we're up against the break, but thank you so much for joining us. There is more just ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The Paralympics open in Rio September 7th. We're looking at the games and how athletes qualify, train, and get their funding. James Zimbetta and Scott Brown are with us for the next 20 minutes or so. James is a wheelchair athlete who will be participating for the first time in the Paralympic Games in the 800-meter, 5,000-meter, and marathon races. And Scott is one of the most decorated athletes in Paralympics rowing's international history. He's also a five-time world champion. And if you'd like to join us, the number to call is 888-477-9499. Our email, radiotimes at whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And let's get to some of the nitty-gritty here. James, to you first about this. You're not going to be competing this time around against the Russian team because the International Paralympic Committee voted to ban Russia from the Paralympic Games because of the doping scandal. What is your reaction to that?
Well, first of all, I would have to say that basically the Russian national delegation, not necessarily the athletes, but the committee themselves, they put in place this state-sanctioned testing protocol that allowed all this doping to happen. So I think because of that, it had the potential to taint the whole sport and as well as the movement. And unlike the Olympics, the Paralympics is still trying to get going. So it was probably better in our case to just make a clean sweep of just getting all the Russians out. With that said, I do have some sympathy for the Russian athletes because it was not their call to necessarily do what was told to them to do, only because I'm not sure who was clean or who did it, but at the same time, if your organization's coming to you and say, like, do this so you can compete or don't do this and we won't take you, I know it's down to an individual athlete to make that call, but at the same time, it's like, oh, I get to compete. I get to go to races worldwide. I get to go to events. I get to represent my nation across the world. Or I stay home and do nothing. It's a tough call for the athlete. But
sure.
For the national organization, it really does hurt the movement in a sense. And I applaud the IPC of making what call they did because it just had to be done.
Scott Brown, it can be tough for a clean athlete to compete clean because if others are winning because they have the edge, some athletes might think, I have no choice. Have you run into that in your sport?
No, I think rowing is a unique sport. Although they did, I just heard that they did ban the Russian rowers, which opened up a spot for the American trunk and arm double, which is a bonus for us, but it's sad again. One of the Olympic slogans is, you know, competing clean, and I'm a firm believer in that. I see no honor in winning if you're cheating. And if these folks are cheating, then yeah, they should be taken out. But if they're not cheating, I think they should be allowed to compete.
Scott, you were about to hang it up when you decided to try a comeback at age 48 and to try to qualify for Rio. As a masters athlete, how does training change for you?
Well, and actually I learned some new things. Jim Mitchell was a head coach at Jacksonville University, and he had just recently gone to the U.S. Rowing Convention. And Tom Terhar is the women's head coach. And as you know, they just took their third gold in their third Olympics. What has changed for me is how I train. I'm not using nearly as much high-intensity training. I'm doing much more long, slow-distance training, and that has made a big, big difference for me. And as you age, it's harder to kind of do those higher-intensity workouts. I mean, it's not harder, but it's tougher on the body. But I've found that the high-intensity training is almost detrimental in comparison to having that really really solid aerobic base that comes from the long, slow distance.
And James Zambetta, what does your training look like these days?
Recently, I'm in a taper, so a little less activity on the track and a little less. Instead of averaging about 80 miles on the road and doing 5,000s galore, and now it's more like, at most, I'm doing about 5,000 meters on a track, splitting it up into 800 meters and 1,500 meters or so. And sometimes it's just a couple of starts. Sometimes it's just maybe one or two 1,500 meters. And
so
basically the rest of the day, it's more rest.
You're tapering, so it's not exhaustive at this point.
Correct.
Okay.
Intense, but not exhausting.
So you're on your way to Rio. Scott, you have been there. I'm assuming that the Paralympic athletes stay in the Olympic Village. And so how are the accommodations, Scott?
They are the same accommodations that the Olympic athletes get. What they do is right now what they're doing in Rio is they're making all of the accessible modifications that haven't been done. So they're just kind of, most of the stuff is generally accessible, but now they're just fine tuning everything in preparation for the wheelchair athletes and for the Paralympic athletes.
And have you been happy with the accommodations, the times you've been there?
Well, I only went to Beijing. Okay. And when you throw how many billions of dollars towards it, it's going to be good. If that's going to be your one Olympics or Paralympics, I think that would be the one to go to. I was absolutely blown away by the level of commitment that they put into the Paralympics. I've always heard that the Paralympics have been kind of an afterthought. You know, it's really about the Olympics, and then we'll throw this Paralympic thing together. And they've been doing much, much better over the years. And I think Beijing, they really took that to the next level.
Well, keeping in mind the ticket sales have now picked up for the Rio Paralympics, one of the tougher challenges facing this Paralympics is funding the Games. Earlier this month, the International Paralympic Committee announced that the Games will take place, but there are major budget cuts. You know, downsizing the Rio workforce is happening. Transport services are being downsized. Some venues are being consolidated. What do you make of this, Scott Brown?
Well, I mean, they're a developing country or nation, it seems to me, in that they had very sparse funds to put into it, and they're doing the best that they can with what they have. I haven't heard many stories about accommodations or anything like that, so I can't speak on that. But hopefully that ticket sales will jump up for them and help them accommodate and make up the deficit. But I don't know a whole lot about that behind the scenes kind of stuff.
Let's talk about funding an athlete to get to the Paralympics on the personal level. James Sembetta, what has your journey been like? What were you facing with funding?
It's been a little tough. To get funding from the USOC, you have to hit certain standards, and they're usually a lot higher than the Paralympic standards. So I was lucky to hit that in the marathon and managed to get a little stipend from there. And honestly, thanks to being a marathoner, I managed to actually collect my income from race checks. Mm-hmm. But outside of that, if you're not, you know, on that level as a marathoner, if you're on the track for the most part, I mean, the stipend will help pay rent and maybe get you some food for the month. But outside of that, you probably would have to get a part-time job or hopefully pick up a sponsor, which is a whole other issue, since if they're not a sponsor with the Olympics, then you have your blackout moment, which actually started today for the Paralympic athletes.
And what's a blackout moment?
The blackout is if your sponsor is not associated with the Olympics or Paralympics, you cannot mention them in social media, and they cannot mention you. You cannot appear in their advertisements on TV, radio, on a magazine.
Okay.
Basically, there can be no association between yourself and your sponsor until a few days after the Paralympics ends.
Okay, thanks for that, James. Yep. Scott Brown, is there a good-sized sponsorship community for Paralympic athletes?
I'm not sure about today, but when I started, I got lucky in that I had an article written about me, and they allowed me to put in a request for donations, and I received enough there. But I think a lot of that's going to depend on the sport. Some sports are, I don't want to say more glamorous than others, but will attract a sponsor's dollars a little better than, you know, some sports are maybe at a disadvantage that way. Hmm. But for me, I tried to search a couple, but just kind of gave up trying to find the sponsors. So I kind of relied on donations and things of that nature to get things going.
Rowing is one of the newer Paralympic sports. As you mentioned, debuted at the 2008 Beijing Games. How's mm-hmm. it faring in 2016?
For in general or for the U.S.?
But for the U.S. team.
I mentioned before, there's three categories: leg, trunk, right. and arms. Trunk and arms, arms and shoulders. The leg, trunk, and arm boat is doing very well. That is a coxed four. So I can see people going, "Huh, what?" it's a whole. You Google it. So they're doing quite well. I watched them at last year's World Championships, and they are a very solid boat. They are very clean. They are very strong competitors. Our men's arms and shoulders boat has a very strong rower in that, and I think he's got a medal contention. And I think that's, yeah.
Okay.
But overall, it's a good team.
I'd like to get to an email from Chip who says, when I was in Rio last week, I visited Sugarloaf Mountain where there was a fan experience site. Inside, I was invited to shoot a basketball standing and then sitting in a wheelchair while holding my legs straight out. It was much harder to shoot from the chair with my legs elevated, which was explained to me as representative of not having legs. It was a powerfully educational moment. It increased my respect and understanding of the Paralympic athletes. James Zambetta, I had no idea that such a fan experience site existed. What do you think?
I love it. It actually allows individuals to gain a better sense of what we have to go through to actually play sports. I mean, in a sense, you said Chip sitting in a chair with his legs out. I mean, let's say wheelchair basketball, there's at least five or six different classifications of athletes. And, you know, let's say the class 101.5, they're a higher level para. So they normally would have their legs high up just because they don't have the abs to really hold themselves up. So they need that dump just to keep themselves stable. So that's one of the things that us as athletes have to go through just to make that adjustment to continue playing.
Yeah, there are many more variables in choosing fielding athletes for the Paralympics, correct, Scott Brown?
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed that.
There are many more variables in fielding athletes for the Paralympics, it seems, as compared to the Olympics, Scott Brown?
Oh, sure. You're dealing with a much smaller pool of athletes in total because now you have classification systems to go through. You have to be, you know, physical disability, that kind of thing. So there's going to be a smaller pool of athletes from which to, you know, pull from. That way, you know, Olympic athletes pretty much have almost everybody. And what the last study I heard, there's 45 million disabled people in the United States. Not all of them would be eligible for adaptive sports or parasports. So it's going to be tough finding those athletes, getting them trained, things of that nature. So I think it's a big hurdle to overcome. And I think a lot of countries are feeling that. I know we feel it here in the States, too. I mean, recruiting is always a big thing.
Who are the stars of these Paralympic Games in your opinion? For instance, swimmer Jessica Long, she's going to be only 24 years old at the 2016 Games. She's of Baltimore, Maryland, and looking to make her fourth consecutive Paralympic appearance. She's won numerous medals. Who are the athletes you are watching? James Zambetta, any favorites?
First, I would have to go with my teammate, Tatiana McFadden. I mean, not only has she won multiple Grand Slams in the marathon, but she's doing everything from the 100 to the marathon and is capable of pulling gold in just about all seven events that she's competing in. So I would have to mention her first.
And Scott Brown?
I am watching Oksana Masters. The last Winter Paralympics, Oksana came out of nowhere to win all kinds of medals in cross-country skiing and is now going to be a cyclist in Rio. And I expect some pretty big things from her. I think she'll do very well.
Okay, a couple names to keep in mind as the we prepare to get the Rio Paralympics underway in just over a week. Again, James, you are flying out to Rio tomorrow. Is there anything, when your competitions are finished, what else do you want to do in Rio? Do you have any plans to explore?
I'll probably explore probably a little bit before the ceremonies begin and maybe a little bit after the marathon, which is on the last day. And so maybe I'll try to check out Sugarloaf Mountain, maybe a little bit.
All right.
Maybe Coca Cabana. Sure.
Well, best of luck to you.
All right. Thank you.
Now, James is a wheelchair athlete competing in the 800-meter, 5,000-meter, and marathon races. And Scott Brown, a seven-time adaptive national team member and one of the most decorated athletes in Paralympic rowing history. Thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
And after the break, we'll be talking about the definition of disability, what it means to be disabled, and disability rights movements. 888-477-9499. Radio Times continues in a moment. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. For the first part of the hour, we talked about the Paralympics, which open in just over a week in Rio. Now we turn our attention to the modern definition of disability, who it includes, and also labels and how accessibility and our culture have changed since the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990. Rosemary Garland-Thompson is professor of English and bioethics at Emory University and co-founding director of the Emory Disability Studies Initiative. And also, if you'd like to get in on the conversation, the number to call is 888-477-9499. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So nice to have you with us, Rosemary.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Mary.
When we're talking about disability, the definition is fairly broad. Could you get into that for us?
Sure. So who counts as disabled and what counts as disability, as many of us know, changes a great deal over time and across cultures. Right now, at this moment in the United States, the primary way of being identified as a person with a disability and the primary institution that tells us what counts as disability is medicine, but also more recently, it's politics, because, of course, the various pieces of legislation that have been designed to provide anti-discrimination recourse for people with disabilities, and also to allow disability integration and desegregation to occur in the United States in terms of justice, has allowed us to come forward and be identified as disabled, as people with disabilities, in order to request accommodations in the workplace, in order to use that legislation that provides social justice. So there are new ways of becoming disabled, that is to say, in terms of our identity and in terms of our understanding ourselves.
And Rosemary, you say most of us are not born into disability, but will enter it as we go through life. How do you mean?
Well, We are all made of flesh and bone and blood, and that essence of ourselves makes us vulnerable to what we call disability as we move through life and encounter a variety of different environments. One way of thinking about becoming disabled is aging, in the sense that all of us will become late life deafened. We will all have a change in our eyesight. We will all have changes in our literal bodies over a lifetime that cause us to be in the category of people with disabilities, and often cause us to need to require the kinds of technologies and accommodations that disability legislation and disability culture and disability technology can provide us. But it can be very difficult to move from one category to another over a lifetime. And sometimes people resist this. Sometimes people don't know what kinds of opportunities are out there. They don't know what kinds of technologies to use. And so this is why disability studies, disability culture, the Paralympics are really important in terms of making the entire population understand that it's possible to live a high quality of life with a disability.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit about yourself, Rosemarie, and do you consider yourself to be disabled?
I do. I was born with a congenital disability, a shortened arm and fewer fingers than most people have. But I didn't ever have any kind of disability consciousness. For one thing, most people who are born with disabilities are not born into families where there are people with disabilities. So I was really rather isolated from disability in general and from other people with disabilities. But as I grew older and learned about the women's movement and the civil rights movements in general in the United States, particularly the Black civil rights movement, I began to understand that there were correlations between disability, whatever that might have meant to me at the time, and the politics of civil and human rights. And I learned that there was a disability rights movement, which, of course, I had no idea until I learned about the women's movement. And so I began to study disability because I was a teacher and a researcher and a scholar, and to think about how I could make contributions to the fields that I worked in, literature, the arts, the humanities in general, that would bring forward disability culture for people who were newly disabled or learning about disability, or, of course, people who have disabled people in their families, Rosemarie, as well as all of us.
In your recent article in the New York Times, you bring up an interesting point about the different rights movements, for instance, you know, the Black Lives Matter or LGBT movements. But when it comes to disabled rights movements, such campaigns don't seem to gain a whole lot of traction. Why not?
Well, in the article, I said that it's, I think, because the definition of what it means to be disabled and who is disabled is very flexible. It's very dynamic. And that's a benefit in terms of identity politics and social justice. But it also has some disadvantages because there's so much flexibility, so much dynamism in the population of who's disabled and the ways of being in the world that count as disabled, that it becomes difficult for many of us to know what that category even means. On the other hand, the changes in the built environment, the changes in the integration and diversity now in at least U.S. society and other rich, developed societies around the world, in terms of who we actually are with every day when we go out into the world, has really brought disability and disability integration forward. But it's subtle in the sense that all of us use say, public transportation or elements of the buildings and the environment that we work in that have been created to integrate people with disabilities into places that we could never go before. Mm-hmm. So, and yet it's not apparent all the time that those changes have taken place.
Rosemary, when you talk about disability integration, what is your reaction when people say, I don't think of you as disabled?
Well, people don't actually say that to me very often, but it has a certain resonance because, of course, we know about how that idea is put out in relation to other identity groups. We've heard a lot about people of color saying that their friends who are white, for example, will often say, I don't think of you as black, mm-hmm. or women often are complimented by men by saying, well, you're really not very feminine and you're just one of the guys. And that kind of reduction or normalization or erasure of the positive identity that many of us have worked to build is something that we, I think, want to try to counter by bringing forward our identities not as negative experiences, but rather as positive experiences. And that can be difficult because all of us who belong to minority groups, if you will, face daily challenges of inaccessibility for people with disabilities, discrimination on either a structural or sometimes an individual level. And so it's very difficult to maintain a really positive identity over time on a day-to-day basis. And I think that things like the Paralympics, things like accessible built environments, really elegant buildings that we enter into, mm-hmm. Heroes such as Peter Dinklage, for example, media personalities who are people with disabilities. It's really important for us to bring those things forward, to cultivate them in helping us to feel positive about the experience of living with disabilities.
Rosemary Garland Thompson, you write, the old way of talking about disability is a curse, tragedy, misfortune, or individual failing is no longer appropriate, but we are unsure about what is more progressive, more polite language to use. So outdated words include what?
Well, there's a lot of anxiety all the way around in social interactions about how to talk about minority group differences and minority group identity, if you will. But I think there's a particular anxiety about really the etiquette of talking about disability. We have so many negative terms that we use as metaphors.
Such as what?
Actual references to disability. We call people idiots all the time. We call people morons. We call people stupid. We call people retarded. We call people lame. We call things insane and crazy. And most of us who use these terms don't realize that they are actually disability slurs. They're ways of denigrating the human variations that we think of as disability. And we don't have any positive language, or at least we don't have very much positive language to use to talk about disability. So people who have some kind of awareness about disability justice, disability identity, are oftentimes nervous that they'll use the wrong language and that they will offend people with disabilities. So I feel like it's important for those of us who think about the cultural work of language, those of us who want to identify as disabled, and those of us who want to promote disability culture and disability justice, to think about and to actually help out with building a vocabulary of equity and respect that we can put forward and that we can offer people.
Give us some examples, Rosemary.
Well, very often what I say is that I say, I identify as disabled, or I'm a person with a disability. And what I say is that this is a positive experience. I work in the area of disability studies. I talk about myself sometimes as an advocate. I announce that in many ways, as much as I can, that to be disabled and to identify as disabled is not shameful, and that it's not a lower form of status. So by simply saying I'm a disabled person, or I have a disability, or I need this kind of accommodation, and not to be reluctant to identify, I think is an important part of the work that we can all do.
What effect, Rosemary, has the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990 had on our culture and accessibility here in 2016?
Well, it's changed everything. Like all civil rights legislation, it's led to a robust community who think of themselves differently, who think of themselves as rights-bearing citizens who have certain legislative and policy implements that they can use to assert their rights as human beings and as full citizens. So that's one thing that it's done. The other thing that it has done is that it's transformed the built environment. So part of the civil rights legislation around disability is to mandate desegregation of structures and institutions in the United States by providing access for people with disabilities. So ramps and the ramping of the entire world, certainly of the United States, that's taken place since the late 1960s, mm-hmm. has changed the way we all move in the world, the way we all are together with one another, rolling suitcases, the use of all sorts of wheeled devices, mm-hmm. plus all sorts of accessible features of the built environment, the doors that open more fully and more accessibly. It goes on forever. Has changed the population and who is with one another in the public environment.
And just switching gears a bit here, Rosemary, since we spent a chunk of the hour talking about the Paralympics, do you have this information at your fingertips as far as sports technology is concerned? What's available to the average person who has a disability who wants to get involved in sports?
Well, there is a great deal available for technologies that allow people to participate in sports as people with disabilities. And this is part of the entire revolution in technology, sometimes called accessible technology, for people with disabilities. That's part of the changes that the disability civil rights movement made happen. So, for example, wheelchairs used to be understood only as medical technologies. They were static things that were designed to be pushed by other people. They were used in medical settings. As a result of the changes in the environment that integrated people into other places that they'd never been, wheelchairs got transformed into devices that people could use that were self-propelled to get around in the world, and more than that, to engage in sport.
So one terrific advancement in technology, and we'll be watching one of our earlier guests compete at the Paralympics coming up. Rosemary Garland Thompson, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times today.
Thank you, Mary.
Rosemary is professor of English and bioethics at Emory University and co-founding director of the Emory Disability Studies Initiatives. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This is Radio Times, and as always, thanks for listening.